Welcome, discerning listeners, to another deep dive, where we cut through the noise and get straight to the insights you need. Today, we're unraveling a truly perplexing situation, one that pits stability against stalled ambition. How can one of Canada's most historically successful and, frankly, fundamentally stable banks, a real fortress in its home market, how can it simultaneously find itself ensnared in this unprecedented regulatory crisis that has effectively frozen its growth in its most vital expansion territory? It's really a tale of two distinct realities coexisting within a single powerhouse institution, and we're about to explore what that duality truly signifies for its future. Our focus today is the Toronto Dominion Bank, or TD as many of you know it. We've taken a comprehensive suite of sources you shared, including detailed investment analyses, recent financial reports, and the rather stark regulatory documents, to meticulously dissect the intricate push and pull between TD's robust Canadian foundation and its now imperiled U.S. growth strategy. Our mission for this deep dive is clear.
To extract the most critical nuggets of knowledge, giving you a crystal clear understanding of TD's current state, the profound challenges it faces, and the strategic crossroads it's navigating. We'll explore precisely why this situation is unique, what the hard numbers reveal, and critically, what the future might hold, all while sidestepping unnecessary jargon. So as we prepare to unpack this fascinating dichotomy, a seemingly unshakable powerhouse at home, yet facing severe, almost existential headwinds abroad, what's the central conflict that underpins this entire narrative?
Yeah, the central conflict here is truly remarkable, and it's laid bare right in the executive summary of our sources. TD is simultaneously a pillar of stability and, well, a bank deeply mired in a severe regulatory crisis. This isn't just a minor setback or, you know, temporary inconvenience. It's a fundamental challenge to its long-term strategic vision. We're witnessing a direct collision between its durable Canadian foundation, which is a source of immense strength, and its imperiled U.S. ambitions. This duality is key for anyone trying to understand TD today, as it impacts everything from its operational strategy right down to its shareholder returns.
That's a stark way to frame it, and it immediately highlights the paradox. Let's begin with that formidable, durable Canadian foundation.
Yeah.
For those less familiar with the Canadian banking system, it's quite distinct, isn't it? Could you paint a picture of its structure and where TD stands within it?
Certainly. The Canadian banking landscape is almost archetypal in its structure. It's often referred to as an oligopoly, and for very sound reasons. It's unequivocally dominated by what are universally known as the Big Six banks.
Right. RBC, TD, Scotiabank, BMO, CIBC, National Bank.
Exactly. Those six. And together, these institutions command an astounding share of the nation's financial wealth. We're talking approximately 93% of Canada's total banking assets.
93%. Wow.
It's huge. And this isn't merely high market concentration. It erects formidable, almost impenetrable barriers to entry for any new competitors. Imagine the monumental challenge of trying to establish a significant new bank and gain traction against institutions so deeply entrenched, you know, with vast customer bases and extensive networks. This unique structure for the incumbents fosters what the sources aptly term rational competition.
Rational competition. What does that mean in practice? Less price wars.
Pretty much. Less cutthroat price wars, fewer aggressive market share battles. It leads instead to more predictable earnings, robust profit margins, and a generally stable operating environment for these established players.
So it's almost like this very exclusive, long-standing club where the rules are well understood and new membership is virtually impossible. That certainly sounds like a recipe for stability and remarkably consistent earnings, something any bank would envy, really. Within this powerful oligopoly, where does TD specifically position itself?
Within this tightly knit group, TD is undoubtedly a dominant force. It's cemented its position as the second largest bank in Canada. That's measured by both its total assets, which for context were around $1.9 trillion Canadian as of, I think, Q3 2023, and its market capitalization. It consistently trails only RBC, the Royal Bank.
Still, number two is pretty significant.
Oh, absolutely. The sheer scale of its customer reach is impressive. It serves over 22 million Canadians and commands a leading market share of about 22.5% across the country. Domestically, its operations are truly vast and deeply integrated into Canadian life. You've got the household name retail arm, TD Canada Trust.
Everyone knows TD Canada Trust.
Right, for everyday banking and commercial services. Then there's TD Wealth, offering private banking and investment advice, and TD Direct Investing, its brokerage platform. The sources consistently highlight that TD ranks either number one or number two in market share across the vast majority of its Canadian retail product lines. This isn't a fluke. It's a direct result of its powerful brand recognition, its extensive distribution network, and decades of cultivating, really entrenched customer loyalty. It's a testament to their long-term focus on the Canadian consumer.
That paints a very clear picture of a domestic behemoth, a genuine powerhouse. But beyond just market share and customer base, how does the Canadian regulatory environment specifically contribute to this fortress of stability that you mentioned earlier? Because often, regulation feels like a burden to businesses, yet here it seems like it's actually a source of strength.
It is indeed a foundational strength, almost a competitive advantage in itself. The Canadian regulatory regime, overseen by OSFI, the Office of the Superintendent of Financial Institutions, is widely recognized as notoriously stringent and proactive.
Proactive, meaning they try to get ahead of issues.
Exactly. As a designated domestic systemically important bank, or DSIB, TD is subjected to significantly enhanced capital requirements. These aren't arbitrary rules. They are specifically designed to ensure its unwavering resilience against economic shocks and, to safeguard the broader Canadian financial system. For example, the minimum common equity tier 1, or CET1, capital ratio mandated for DSIBs currently stands at 11.5%.
And that includes buffers.
Right. This figure is comprehensive. It incorporates a 1% DSEB surcharge because of its systemic importance and a 3.5% domestic stability buffer. That acts as an additional countercyclical cushion to absorb potential losses during periods of stress. Furthermore, OSFI implements a critical capital floor rule.
Okay, what's that?
It basically dictates that a bank's risk-weighted assets, when calculated using its own sophisticated internal models, must be no less than 67.5% of what they would be under a more conservative, standardized approach. This rule is ingeniously designed to prevent capital levels from falling below a prudent threshold, ensuring banks don't take undue risks by, let's say, overly optimizing their internal capital math.
Those sound like incredibly robust and well-thought-out measures, truly designed for resilience. So how well does TD actually navigate and meet these demanding regulatory requirements? Do they just scrape by or?
Oh, no, they don't just meet them. They comfortably exceed them. TD's capital position is truly exceptional. It provides a significant cushion against unforeseen events. To be precise, its CET1 ratio stood at an impressive 14.9% as of the second quarter of 2025.
14.9%. That's way above the 11.5 minimum.
Way above. And importantly, it's the highest among all of its big six Canadian peers. So if we step back and connect this to the broader picture, TD's immense capital strength, coupled with the stringent and proactive Canadian regulatory environment, is genuinely impressive. It represents a foundational stability that, frankly, most banks globally would envy. It speaks volumes about the prudential, cautious approach embedded within the Canadian banking system.
That absolutely makes sense. This portrait of domestic stability, strong market share, robust capital, it makes TD sound like an unshakable giant. But here's where it gets really interesting. This very domestic strength, once a pure and unadulterated advantage, now forces a difficult, almost paradoxical strategic question for TD, doesn't it? What do you do when your home market is so incredibly stable, so mature, that it's almost, well, too stable for the kind of aggressive growth a major bank often seeks?
That's the core paradox, and you've articulated it perfectly. While historically a source of immense power, the mature and saturated nature of the Canadian market now undeniably presents a fundamental strategic challenge for TD. The sources clearly highlight that with the top five banks already controlling over 86% of the market, well, opportunities for truly significant organic growth within Canada are inherently limited.
86% between just five banks leaves very little room.
Very little. So when an institution possesses a massive amount of capital, as TD demonstrably does, deploying that capital effectively into such a low-growth environment largely means competing for incremental market share against entrenched peers. And this isn't just difficult. The sources describe it as an expensive, margin-compressing endeavor.
So fighting tooth and nail for tiny bits of market share, basically.
Which eats into your profits. It effectively compels banks like TD to look beyond their national borders for substantial, needle-moving growth opportunities. And that, of course, is precisely what TD pursued for well over a decade with its ambitious U.S. expansion strategy.
Ah, so the plot thickens. This inherent stability in Canada, then, became a catalyst, effectively pushing TD to look south to the American market. For over a decade, the U.S. was indeed seen as its great hope, its primary engine for growth. Tell us about that American dream. What did TD manage to build and achieve in the U.S. before circumstances took such a dramatic turn?
For, well over a decade, the core of TD's growth narrative revolved around its highly successful expansion into the United States. It operated under the distinct brand of TD Bank, America's most convenient bank.
I remember those ads.
Yeah.
Very prominent branding.
Very. And it wasn't just a catchy slogan. It represented a deeply ingrained strategy built on a retail-focused service model and a clear pathway for growth, primarily through strategic acquisitions. This approach allowed TD to establish a truly substantial physical footprint. We're talking about an impressive network of over 1,100 retail locations
Over 1,100 branches.
and more than 2,700 ATMs strategically concentrated in high-value, populous markets all along the U.S. East Coast. Think Maine all the way down to Florida, including the critical D.C. area.
That's an absolutely massive network they built up. They truly established a significant presence there, didn't they?
They absolutely did. This extensive network serves a large and continuously growing customer base of over 10 million U.S. clients. To put its scale into perspective, TD Bank, N.A., that's their U.S. subsidiary, ranks as one of the 10 largest banks in the U.S. by total assets.
Top 10 in the U.S. That's huge for a Canadian bank subsidiary.
It is. And impressively, the seventh largest by deposits. This is a considerable achievement, competing fiercely against giants like JPMorgan Chase and Bank of America, plus strong super regional players. Historically, TD's competitive edge in this market was its unique retail-focused service model. They really leaned into customer convenience with longer branch hours, weekend service.
Right, the convenient bank thing.
Exactly, and a strong local community presence. That branding was powerful.
And this U.S. venture wasn't merely about expanding their footprint, was it? It was fundamentally integral to their financial strategy, designed to significantly enhance their overall profitability.
Precisely. This U.S. segment was, without question, the bank's key growth engine. It was meticulously designed to leverage the higher margins available in the American market. To give you a concrete example, in the first quarter of 2023, the U.S. retail bank's net interest margin, or M,
That's a key profitability measure right
a
there.
crucial one, it was a robust 3.29%. Now compare that to the Canadian P&C segment's NM of 2.81% in Q3 2024.
Okay, so nearly half a percent higher margin in the U.S. That's significant.
Significant. It's very significant. That margin differential made the U.S. market an irresistible magnet for growth and a powerful lever for enhancing overall profitability for TD.
So a thriving U.S. operation delivering significantly higher margins, serving as a clear and potent growth engine. And then, as you put it, the abrupt halt.
Well.
This is where the story pivots sharply into the regulatory storm. We're talking about the anti-money laundering, or AML, crisis, aren't we? What exactly transpired that brought this dynamic growth engine to a standstill?
That's precisely right. This once vibrant growth engine has been brought to an abrupt and, frankly, complete halt by severe regulatory actions. And these all stem from profound and systemic failures within the bank's AML compliance programs. This wasn't a sudden, isolated oversight. It involved longstanding U.S. investigations into its Bank Secrecy Act, BSA, and AML compliance programs that span an astonishing nearly a decade.
Nearly 10 years.
Yeah, from January 2014 all the way to October 2023. The scope and sheer severity of these failures, as detailed by the Department of Justice and FinCEN, were truly profound. They directly enabled at least three separate money laundering networks to illicitly move more than $670 million in funds through the bank between 2019 and 2023 alone.
Willfully deficient is a chilling phrase that sources use to characterize their AML program. Could you elaborate on some of the most egregious and specific failures that were identified? Because these details are absolutely crucial to grasping the true depth of this problem.
The specifics are frankly alarming, and they really speak to a systemic breakdown. First, and perhaps the most staggering revelation, was that the bank intentionally excluded approximately 92% of its total transaction volume.
92%.
Yes, amounting to an estimated $18.3 trillion from its automated transaction monitoring system.
$18 trillion excluded. How is that even possible?
It's hard to comprehend. This massive blind spot included all domestic automated clearinghouse, or ACH, transactions and the vast majority of check activity. Essentially, they had consciously switched off a huge portion of their critical risk detection capabilities.
Wow, that's far beyond a simple oversight. That sounds like a fundamental systemic decision. What other failures compounded this?
Beyond that, for an astonishing 8 consecutive years, from 2014 through 2022, TD failed to add any new risk detection scenarios to its transaction monitoring program.
For 8 years, no updates.
No new scenarios added. This happened despite known deficiencies in their system, despite launching new products and services, and despite the fact that money laundering threats are constantly evolving, becoming more sophisticated. It's like their detection system was frozen in time while the criminal underworld was constantly innovating. And it wasn't just about the technology or the lack of scenarios. There were also major operational breakdowns. The bank allowed significant backlogs of unresolved, suspicious activity alerts to accumulate, which critically deprived law enforcement agencies of timely, actionable intelligence needed to combat financial crime.
And then there's the even more troubling revelation that directly points to human misconduct: employee complicity.
Yes, this aspect is particularly concerning, and I think indicative of deeper cultural issues. The failures weren't merely systemic or procedural, they extended to direct involvement from staff. The sources unequivocally reveal that at least five TD employees were found to have assisted one of the criminal networks in laundering $39 million to entities in Colombia.
Employees actively helping launder money inside the bank.
Exactly. This points to a profound breakdown, not just in technology or process, but in the fundamental integrity and ethical conduct of staff directly involved in the bank's operations.
Given the gravity and systemic nature of these failures, it was clear regulators wouldn't just issue a slap on the wrist. What was the hammer that ultimately came down on TD? What were the financial penalties and, perhaps even more importantly, what were the non-monetary consequences?
Well, the resolution arrived in October 2024. It culminated in a total financial settlement of approximately US $3.09 billion.
Over $3 billion.
A huge sum. Although the sources indicate that a significant portion was largely covered by prior provisions the bank had already set aside, anticipating this. The breakdown included a combined $1.8 billion payment to the Department of Justice, which notably represents the single largest penalty ever imposed under the Bank Secrecy Act.
The largest ever BSA penalty.
Ever. Plus a record $1.3 billion civil penalty from FinCEN. Additional fines included $450 million from the OCC and $123.5 million from the Federal Reserve, which were credited towards that total. However, and this is a critical distinction, the sources emphasize the non-monetary penalties are far more damaging to the long-term investment thesis.
Already damaging than a $3 billion fine. What are they?
The most significant and potentially crippling of these is an unprecedented and indefinite asset cap of US $434 billion on TD's US bank subsidiaries.
An asset cap, meaning they can't grow their US balance sheet beyond that level?
Exactly. It effectively freezes the US balance sheet in its tracks. It categorically precludes both any future merger and acquisition activity, which, as we discussed, was a cornerstone of TD's US growth strategy for over a decade, and also any significant organic loan growth.
So it's not merely a multi-billion dollar fine they have to absorb. It's a complete indefinite halt to their ability to grow and expand in their most dynamic market. That's an extraordinary restriction.
It truly is. And compounding this, the bank is now subject to more stringent approval processes for new bank products, services, markets, and stores. This extra bureaucratic layer will inevitably stifle innovation and expansion efforts. It basically transforms the U.S. segment from its anticipated primary source of future growth into a major source of ongoing expense, management distraction, and, well, strategic paralysis. This raises a vital question for us and for investors. What's more damaging to a bank like TD, a multi-billion dollar fine that can eventually be paid, or an indefinite freeze on its ability to grow in its most dynamic market? The sources strongly suggest the latter, the freeze, is the truly crippling blow. It impacts its long-term strategy and profitability far more profoundly than the direct financial penalties.
That's a stark thought, and it certainly points to something far deeper than just technical failures or oversight. The sources also explicitly discuss cultural issues and the significant brand damage this crisis has inflicted. Mm. What does this mean for a brand once proudly proclaimed as America's most convenient bank?
Well, the nature of these failures, particularly the sustained employee complicity and the sheer duration of the problems, strongly points to a deep-seated issue, one that transcends purely technical systems and extends deep into the bank's culture. The Department of Justice explicitly cited that senior executives enforced a flat cost paradigm.
Flat cost paradigm, meaning cost cutting above all else.
Essentially, yes. They systematically prioritized cost control and customer experience over fundamental regulatory obligations. This effectively starved the AML compliance function of the necessary resources and, maybe more importantly, the executive attention it desperately needed to be effective.
And then there's that truly astonishing detail about the leaked internal communications. Speaks volumes, doesn't it?
It really does. Leaked internal communications revealed staff joking about watching money laundering happen in real time.
Joking about it.
Joking. This isn't just a minor detail. It's a profound indicator. It suggests a pervasive culture of indifference, maybe even outright willful blindness, to illicit activity occurring within their systems. Such deeply entrenched cultural issues are exponentially more challenging and time-consuming to rectify than merely upgrading software or implementing new procedures. This strongly implies a multi-year, arduous path to satisfying regulators and ultimately lifting those growth restrictions. And the brand damage to America's most convenient bank, now irrevocably associated with the largest AML penalty in U.S. history, that's substantial, too.
Competitors must be looking at that.
Absolutely. Competitors could and likely will vigorously exploit this reputational harm to attract discerning customers, particularly in small business and commercial lending. It could lead to slower customer growth and higher attrition in the U.S. even after the asset cap is eventually lifted.
That certainly brings us squarely to the financial impact. We've talked strategy and reputation, but let's dissect the financials. How do these unprecedented issues translate into tangible performance pressure for TD? What does the bank's revenue picture look like now with this U.S. growth engine stalled?
Well, TD's revenue streams typically come from four main segments: Canadian P&C, U.S. retail, wealth management and insurance, and wholesale banking. The Canadian P&C segment has historically been the bedrock, and its importance is now even more pronounced given the U.S. situation. In Q2 2025, this segment contributed a substantial 39.1% of the bank's adjusted earnings. That really underscores its role as the core stable profit engine. It continues to exhibit stable, albeit moderate, growth. Average loan and deposit volumes increased by a healthy 6% and 5% year over year, respectively, in Q3 2024, demonstrating its resilience.
In the U.S. retail segment, which was explicitly targeted to be a major growth driver and profitability engine, how does it factor in now?
You hit on a crucial point. The U.S. retail segment was historically aimed at achieving a significant 40% revenue split for the entire bank, precisely to leverage those higher margins we discussed.
Right, the 40% target.
But with the indefinite U.S. asset cap now firmly in place, this strategic balance will inevitably shift. The bank's earnings profile will revert towards a greater reliance on its mature Canadian domestic market. Fortunately, TD also possesses robust, fee-based, non-interest income streams generated by its wealth management and insurance segment.
Less capital-intensive, right?
Exactly. Less capital-intensive and less directly impacted by the U.S. asset cap. It reported strong results in Q2 2025 net income of $707 million, up a solid 14% year-over-year, primarily driven by higher insurance premiums and fee-based revenue from growing assets under management. The wholesale banking segment, which includes TD Securities, also offers more volatile but potentially high return revenues. It posted a record revenue of $2.1 billion in Q2 2025, partly thanks to significant advisory fees from that Charles Schwab share sale.
So we're seeing a clear forced shift in the revenue mix. Canada and fee-based income streams are taking on greater weight. How are TD's overall profitability metrics, like return on equity, stacking up against its peers now that its U.S. growth is frozen?
TD's adjusted return on equity, or ROE, that key measure of how efficiently a company generates profits from shareholders' equity, was 12.3% in Q2 2025.
12.3%. How does that compare?
Well, while that's certainly a solid figure, it notably lags its main Canadian competitor, RBC. RBC reported a higher 14.7% adjusted ROE in the same period. This emerging profitability gap is quite significant because the sustainability of TD's historical ROE premium is now very much in question, precisely because its highest margin, highest growth U.S. business is severely restricted from expanding.
Makes sense. The engine isn't firing.
Right. And the efficiency ratio, which gauges non-interest expenses as a percentage of revenue, is also under pressure. It stood at 57.6% in Q2 2025. A significant and persistent headwind here is the substantial cost of the U.S. AML remediation program. These governance and control investments are directly contributing to a notable 13% year-over-year decline in the U.S. retail segment's adjusted net income in Q2 2025.
And these critical remediation costs stemming from the AML crisis, they aren't going to simply disappear anytime soon, are they?
No, not at all. Analysts expect these costs to remain elevated at approximately $500 million annually, extending well into 2026.
$500 million a year just on fixing this.
Pretty much. This creates a significant long-term drag on the U.S. segment's profitability and, by extension, exerts pressure on the bank's overall operating leverage. So, as you keenly observed, the U.S. crisis isn't solely about the initial fines. It's actively eroding their ability to be as profitable and efficient as their peers. It's akin to running a race with a significant constant lead weight attached, hindering every step forward.
That's a powerful analogy. Now, let's turn to the Charles Schwab sale. This was a notable event that generated a substantial amount of capital for TD. Was this purely a strategic win, or does it also carry a hidden downside in the context of their current predicament?
That's an excellent question, and it's definitely a double-edged sword. The sale of TD's remaining equity investment in the Charles Schwab Corporation in Q2 2025 was, without a doubt, a notable event. It generated a massive reported net income of $11.1 billion for the quarter.
$11 billion.
Including an after-tax gain of $8.6 billion. This was undeniably a significant capital-generating event that dramatically boosted the bank's Common Equity Tier 1, or CET1, ratio. On the surface, it appears to be a huge positive, bolstering their capital reserves at a critical time.
But there's a deeper implication, is there, especially given the timing?
Precisely. The sources are clear that while financially impactful, this sale also creates a misleading picture of the bank's underlying performance. If you strip out this extraordinary gain and focus on the core adjusted net income for the quarter, it was actually down 4% year over year to $3.6 billion.
Ah, so the underlying business was weaker.
Exactly. Indicating a weaker operational performance beneath the headline numbers. More strategically, this divestment removes a consistent and high-quality earnings stream from a U.S. wealth management leader. This is a crucial point. This was a capital-light, fee-based U.S. asset, which TD decided to sell at the precise moment its capital-intensive U.S. banking asset was frozen by the regulatory actions.
Ouch. Bad timing.
Yeah, the result is a less diversified and notably more Canada-centric earnings profile for the future, which fundamentally alters the bank's long-term strategic trajectory, especially for an institution that was so heavily invested in U.S. expansion.
That really clarifies the mixed blessing of the Schwab sale. They jettisoned a good, stable U.S. earner just as their other, more capital-intensive U.S. operations hit a brick wall. So amidst all these challenges and strategic shifts, how is TD's credit quality holding up, and what are the emerging risks that analysts are particularly concerned about?
Well, TD generally operates with a conservative risk appetite, and its credit performance is naturally intrinsically linked to the broader health of the North American economy. In Q2 2025, the bank's total provision for credit losses, or PCL, was $1.0 billion. Management has provided guidance for a PCL on loans ratio in the range of 45-55 basis points for the fiscal year. That's generally in line with its major Canadian peers like RBC, which reported 58 basis points in the same quarter.
Are there any subtle early warning signs beneath those aggregate numbers that warrant closer attention?
Yes, the granular analysis of these provisions does reveal some early signs of potential stress. In Q3 2024, the bank specifically noted an increase in PCL on performing loans. That's loans that aren't yet impaired.
Okay, why the increase there?
It was primarily driven by credit migration in the commercial and consumer lending portfolios. This means that some borrowers are showing signs of weakness, potentially moving into higher risk categories. And this is a trend that absolutely warrants close monitoring as a leading indicator of future impaired loans and eventual write-offs. A particularly significant risk for TD, in fact, for all major Canadian banks, stems from its substantial concentration in Canadian real estate within its overall loan portfolio.
The Canadian housing market concern, always there.
Always. A sharp or prolonged downturn in the Canadian housing market, especially in historically overheated markets like Ontario and British Columbia, could realistically lead to a material increase in credit losses and exert significant pressure on earnings.
Okay, so we're seeing a mixed financial picture. Canada remains a strong anchor, but the U.S. is undeniably a significant and persistent drag. Let's now shift our focus to the balance sheet and capital management. You mentioned earlier that TD's capital position is exceptionally strong. Could you elaborate on the significance of this strength, particularly in the context of its current strategic dilemma?
Absolutely. TD's capital position is, without question, a monumental area of strength. It provides immense financial flexibility, acting as a crucial buffer. As of the end of Q2 2025, its Common Equity Tier 1, or CET1, ratio stood at an exceptionally robust 14.9%.
That 14.9% again really stands out.
It does, and it isn't just comfortably above the 11.5% minimum regulatory requirement set by OSFI for D-SIBs. It is remarkably the highest among all its Big Six Canadian peers.
Okay.
And as we discussed, this substantial surge in the CET1 ratio was primarily attributable to that significant capital gain realized from the sale of its remaining equity investment in Charles Schwab.
So they possess a truly enormous capital buffer. What does that signify in practical terms regarding their resilience and their ability to withstand further shocks?
This robust capital base is absolutely critical. It provides significant financial flexibility and resilience for absorbing any potential losses, particularly during an unforeseen credit downturn or broader economic contraction. And it helps them comfortably meet the stringent requirements of the global regulatory framework. As a D-SIB, TD is also mandated to comply with Total Loss Absorbing Capacity, or TLAC, rules.
TLAC. Those are the rules to prevent bailouts, right?
Exactly. Stringent international standards designed to ensure that if a systemically important bank were ever to encounter severe distress or failure, it could be recapitalized and resolved in an orderly manner without needing taxpayer money. OSFI's minimum requirements dictate a risk-based TLAC ratio of 25% of risk-weighted assets and a TLAC leverage ratio of 7.25%. TD's currently exceptionally strong capital position comfortably supports its compliance with all these demanding requirements.
So, an impressive amount of capital, which is great for stability, but we also identify limited growth avenues, especially in the U.S. This directly leads to a capital allocation dilemma, doesn't it? What does a bank do with all that excess capital if it cannot effectively grow its U.S. business, its traditional growth engine?
That's precisely the strategic dilemma TD faces. Despite the profound challenges in the U.S., TD has continued to return capital to shareholders. It increased its dividend by 6% for fiscal 2024, for example, and has been actively repurchasing shares. They bought back 30 million shares in Q2 2025 alone.
So they are returning some capital.
They are. But the core strategic issue remains. The bank is undeniably overcapitalized with limited avenues for value accretive deployment due to the U.S. growth freeze and the recent Schwab monetization. This excess capital, if it's not efficiently reinvested into genuinely growing business lines that generate strong returns, can ironically act as a drag on the bank's overall return on equity.
Too much capital sitting idle can actually hurt returns.
It can dilute them, yes. This raises an important question. When you possess a fortress balance sheet, but your most dynamic growth engine is indefinitely blocked, what truly is the optimal strategy for deploying all that capital? It's a good problem to have in one sense, but it presents a very real and urgent strategic challenge nonetheless. The sources strongly suggest that an acceleration of share buybacks may be necessary as a primary mechanism to manage its substantial capital levels and support shareholder returns in the absence of more impactful, growth-oriented deployment opportunities.
That's a truly fascinating challenge, having such a robust capital base, but nowhere truly compelling or value accretive to deploy it for growth. What about TD's asset quality and funding stability in this rather uncertain and challenging environment?
Well, the bank's asset quality generally remains sound. That stability is largely supported by a continued, albeit moderate, growth in its core Canadian loan book. In Q3 2024, the Canadian P&C segment reported average loan volumes increasing by 6% year over year, showcasing balanced growth across both personal and business lending portfolios. This really demonstrates the ongoing stability and demand within its primary mature market.
And their funding. Deposits.
On the funding side, TD benefits enormously from a large, incredibly stable, and notably low-cost base of retail deposits, particularly within Canada. Canadian P&C deposit volumes grew by a healthy 5% year-over-year in Q3 2024. This deeply entrenched Canadian deposit franchise is a crucial competitive advantage. It provides a reliable and exceptionally cost-effective source of funding for the bank's extensive lending activities.
A cheap source of money, basically.
Exactly. And this picture stands in stark contrast to the U.S. retail segment, where average deposit volumes actually declined by 6% in Q2 2024.
Deposits down 6% in the U.S.
It reflects both intense competition for deposits in a higher interest rate environment and, you know, the undeniable potential for reputational fallout stemming from the bank's ongoing regulatory issues.
That really highlights the pronounced difference between their Canadian and U.S. deposit performance, further underscoring the tale of two banks. Let's delve back into the major developments specifically, building on our earlier discussion of the AML overhang. We've comprehensively detailed the nature and extent of the U.S. regulatory failure. Now, the crucial question shifts from what happened to what are they doing about it and what does it truly mean for their path forward? Let's look at the ongoing remediation effort and the deep-seated cultural shifts required.
Yeah, having fully grasped the devastating scale and systemic nature of those AML failures we dissected earlier, the intentional exclusion of $18.3 trillion, the 8 years of stagnant risk detection, the backlogs, and especially the employee complicity. The focus now irrevocably shifts to the arduous journey of remediation. The profound and systemic nature of these failures implies this isn't just a technical fix, it requires a fundamental overhaul. The sources explicitly point to pervasive cultural issues that are proving far more challenging and time-consuming to rectify than software upgrades. The DOJ's findings, highlighting that senior executives enforced that flat cost paradigm.
Right, cost control over compliance.
Directly prioritized cost control over crucial regulatory obligations. And that astonishing anecdote about staff joking about watching money laundering happen in real time, that isn't just a shocking detail, it is deeply symptomatic of a culture of indifference or even willful blindness that must be systematically dismantled.
When you read about staff joking about watching money laundering happen in real time, it really brings home that this wasn't just a technical glitch or an isolated error. It suggests something deeply embedded. So what does this all mean for TD's concrete path forward, particularly regarding this remediation?
It means TD is now unequivocally embarking on a long, expensive, and uncertain journey of remediation. This entire process will be meticulously overseen by an independent compliance monitor for an extended period, expected to last anywhere from 3 to 5 years, with direct reporting lines to U.S. authorities.
3 to 5 years with an independent monitor watching over them.
Yes. To address this, the bank has already appointed a U.S. regulatory remediation officer and committed to significant investments in technology, specifically citing advanced machine learning tools, alongside a substantial increase in personnel dedicated to completely overhauling its compliance framework. These intensive efforts are projected to incur those ongoing costs of approximately $500 million per year, which, as we discussed, will create a material and persistent drag on earnings for the foreseeable future. This deep regulatory quagmire forces a fundamental strategic pivot for the entire bank, reshaping its priorities and direction.
So an arduous path to remediation with significant recurring costs leading to a forced strategic pivot. What are the specific actionable details of that strategic pivot for TD now?
This pivot has several critical components. First, there's a renewed and intensified focus on Canada. This means dedicating greater emphasis and resources to defending its existing market share and actively seeking to gain incremental share within its mature but undeniably highly profitable domestic market. This will involve substantial investment in its Canadian digital platforms, enhancing customer acquisition strategies, and deepening customer relationships in its home base.
Doubling down on the home turf.
Exactly. Second, we'll see an accelerated digital transformation. The bank is doubling down on its technology investments, things like enterprise data migration to the cloud, significant expansion of AI capabilities. The goal here is to drive both operational efficiencies and genuinely enhance customer experiences as a primary means of generating organic growth in a capital-light manner.
Using tech to grow without needing massive balance sheet expansion.
Precisely. And third, there will likely be increased capital returns. With fewer genuinely compelling avenues for growth-oriented capital deployment, particularly due to the U.S. freeze, the pressure to return this excess capital to shareholders through increased dividends and more aggressive share repurchase programs will inevitably intensify. And, you know, the lingering brand damage with America's most convenient bank now linked to the largest AML penalty ever, that also creates a competitive challenge, as rivals might well leverage this narrative.
That's a truly comprehensive and rather dramatic shift in strategy.
Yeah.
All of this, then, brings us directly to valuation. Why is TD currently trading at such a persistent discount compared to its Canadian peers? What are the market's trading multiples telling us about investor sentiment?
Yeah, an incisive analysis of TD's valuation multiples clearly reveals a significant and sustained discount relative to its primary Canadian peers. And this isn't arbitrary. It's a direct and emphatic reflection of the market pricing and the profound uncertainty and the undeniable growth impairment from the U.S. AML crisis. For instance, TD's trailing 12-month price-to-earnings, or PE, ratio stands at approximately 11.4 as of, say, August 2025.
11.4. How does that compare again?
It's notably below its own 10-year historical average of 12.0 and, crucially, represents a substantial discount to its closest competitors. RBC trades at a PE of around 15.4, BMO at 15.7, and Scotiabank at 15.0.
So that's a very clear and substantial gap in PE. And how does its price-to-book ratio compare?
Similarly, TD's price-to-book, or PB, ratio of approximately 1.4 is notably well below that of the Canadian market leader, RBC, which currently trades at a PB ratio of around 2.0.
Price to book is often linked to return on equity, right?
It is, intrinsically. A bank's PB multiple is tied to its ability to generate strong returns on its equity, its ROE. This persistent discount strongly indicates that the market harbors significant skepticism about the sustainability of TD's historical ROE premium in an environment where its highest return growth engine, the U.S. retail segment, is essentially stalled. This really highlights that the market isn't just reacting to the financial penalty, it's fundamentally pricing in the lost opportunity and the future growth constraints.
So the market's saying, we don't believe you can earn the returns you used to without that U.S. growth.
That's a fair interpretation. While the forward dividend yield around 4.12% certainly offers some valuation support for income-focused investors, it clearly isn't enough to fully offset these deep-seated growth concerns.
That makes it sound like the market is very much adopting a show-me approach, waiting for clear evidence of a turnaround. How does a conceptual sum-of-the-parts valuation help us to further quantify this value destruction?
A conceptual sum-of-the-parts, or SOTP analysis, is exceptionally useful here for truly quantifying the embedded value destruction caused by these AML issues. When we dissect TD into its individual business segments, well, the stable, high-quality segments like Canadian P&C and wealth management and insurance would rationally command valuations in line with, or even at a slight premium to, the broader Canadian peer average.
Because they're stable and profitable.
Exactly. Reflects their robust market positions, consistent profitability, the stability of the Canadian oligopoly. Wholesale banking, TD Securities, would typically be valued in line with other capital markets peers, which generally trade at lower multiples due to the inherent volatility of earnings in that sector. However, the truly critical component in this analysis is the U.S. retail segment. Pre-crisis, a valuation model would have assigned this segment a significant premium multiple due to its higher growth potential and superior margins compared to Canada. But in its current constrained state, a significant regulatory discount must be applied.
A discount specifically for the regulatory problems.
Absolutely. This U.S. franchise must now be valued conceptually as a no-growth, high-expense entity until those consent orders are definitively lifted. This substantial discount accounts for the indefinite asset cap, the roughly $500 million in annual remediation costs, and, perhaps most critically, the immense opportunity cost of lost growth. When viewed through this SOTT framework, it becomes starkly evident that a substantial, arguably irreversible portion of the U.S. franchise's embedded value has been impaired.
So the U.S. growth potential is essentially being written down to almost zero in the market's valuation. Given all these complex factors, how does the future valuation of TD Bank hinge almost entirely on the resolution of its U.S. regulatory situation? What are the distinct scenarios we could realistically consider?
Yeah, the future valuation of TD is, without exaggeration, almost entirely contingent on the outcome and timeline of its U.S. regulatory situation. We can conceptualize three primary scenarios that investors and analysts are considering. The base case scenario assumes that the U.S. asset cap and heightened regulatory scrutiny will remain firmly in place for an extended period, likely the next 2 to 3 years. In this scenario, the ongoing remediation costs will continue to be a significant drag on earnings, acting as a persistent weight. The bank's primary focus will revert to modest organic growth within its Canadian operations and consistently returning capital to shareholders through dividends and buybacks.
And the stock price.
Under these conditions, the current valuation discount to its peers would likely persist, as the market sees no immediate catalyst for re-rating.
What's the more optimistic outlook, the bull case, that could potentially re-energize the stock?
The bull case scenario envisions a faster-than-expected resolution to the regulatory issues. Regulators would become satisfied with the remediation progress, and, critically, the asset cap would be lifted within a shorter time frame, say, 12 to 18 months.
That would be quick.
It would. This would act as a powerful catalyst, immediately allowing the market to reprice in a renewed U.S. growth story and likely leading to significant multiple expansion for the stock. This is the scenario that investors hoping for a quick turnaround and significant capital appreciation are closely watching for.
And what about the worst case scenario, the bear case, that keeps investors up at night?
The bear case scenario paints a more challenging picture. It envisions a prolonged period, perhaps 5 years or even more, in the regulatory penalty box.
5 years or more under the asset cap.
Yeah. This could be triggered by the discovery of further compliance lapses, a failure to adequately reform its underlying risk culture, or simply a slower than expected remediation process. Critically, this could be compounded by a severe and protracted correction in the Canadian housing market, leading to a sharp spike in credit losses.
A perfect storm scenario.
Pretty much. In this outcome, the bank's earnings would decline significantly, and its valuation multiple would likely contract further, creating a very difficult and protracted situation for shareholders.
These scenarios truly underscore the profound uncertainty currently surrounding TD. Let's wrap up our deep dive by examining the key investment risks. What are the specific factors that genuinely keep investors up at night regarding TD Bank?
Okay, from a company-specific standpoint, the paramount risk is undeniably the regulatory overhang and timeline uncertainty. The indefinite nature of the U.S. growth restrictions creates this deep cloud of uncertainty that will continue to weigh heavily on the stock's valuation and constrain its strategic direction for the foreseeable future.
Just not knowing when it ends.
Exactly. Then there's credit cycle severity. While the bank's credit quality is currently stable, a sharper than expected economic downturn in North America would directly impact provisions for credit losses, ultimately hitting earnings and capital. There's also considerable operational and execution risk. TD is tasked with simultaneously executing a complex multi-year AML remediation program under the constant scrutiny of an independent monitor, while also pursuing its broader strategic objectives like digital transformation and Canadian growth.
Juggling multiple critical priorities under pressure.
Right. Failure to navigate this dual challenge could lead to further penalties, prolonged restrictions, or a significant loss of competitive position. And of course, like all major financial institutions, there are constant technology and cybersecurity threats. A successful breach could result in significant financial losses, substantial regulatory fines, and severe lasting reputational damage.
And beyond the company itself, what are the broader industry and macro risks that TD's exposed to?
On the macro front, TD's substantial exposure to the Canadian residential mortgage market makes it particularly vulnerable to a Canadian housing market correction. Forecasts for 2025 are cautious. Some project a national average price decline of around 2%, others a modest gain, but with notable weakness concentrated in those key markets of Ontario and British Columbia.
BC and Ontario are always the ones to watch there.
Definitely. A sharp increase in unemployment combined with falling home prices would represent a significant headwind. Also, interest rate sensitivity is always a critical factor. Unforeseen monetary policy changes by either the Bank of Canada or the U.S. Federal Reserve could significantly impact net interest margins and loan demand. A prolonged higher-for-longer interest rate scenario could particularly pressure borrowers with variable-rate mortgages.
Squeezing homeowners.
Yeah. Right. And, naturally, a broad-based economic recession across North America would lead to reduced investment, lower consumer spending, rising unemployment, negatively affecting credit quality across all loan portfolios. Finally, competitive pressure from non-bank lenders is an ongoing, evolving threat. The rapid pace of fintech disruption in areas like payments, personal lending, and wealth management could lead to long-term margin compression for traditional banks like TD if they don't innovate effectively.
Wow. That was an incredibly thorough and illuminating deep dive into the Toronto Dominion Bank. We've explored everything from its unshakable Canadian fortress to the profound and systemic regulatory storm it's weathering in its crucial U.S. expansion market. We've dissected the systemic failures, the multi-billion dollar penalties, and that truly damaging indefinite asset cap that has completely frozen its growth in America. We've seen how this profound duality impacts its financials, forcing a significant strategic pivot back to its mature domestic market, and precisely why the market is currently applying such a significant discount to its valuation.
So what does this all mean for you, the informed observer? It means understanding that even the largest, most stable financial institutions can face profound and unexpected challenges. TD's situation is really a masterclass in how compliance failures, especially those deeply rooted in internal culture and cost prioritization paradigms, can derail even the most carefully constructed long-term growth strategy and fundamentally reshape a bank's future. It powerfully underscores the critical importance of robust risk management and unwavering ethical operations, especially in today's interconnected and increasingly scrutinized global financial system.
That's a powerful takeaway, highlighting that even giants can be brought to a halt by internal failings. And it leaves us with some truly intriguing questions to ponder as you continue to follow this unfolding story. As we leave this deep dive, consider these critical questions.
First, what truly measurable milestones, beyond just spending money, will signal to U.S. regulators and investors that TD's cultural and operational remediation is genuinely complete and that the asset cap can finally be lifted? How do you think they'll prove this profound turnaround?
Second, with its U.S. growth effectively frozen for the foreseeable future, how does TD strategically deploy its substantial excess capital to genuinely satisfy shareholders? And is accelerated share repurchase truly a sustainable long-term solution for value creation, or merely a temporary stopgap?
And finally, how resilient is that Canadian fortress truly, particularly its massive mortgage portfolio, against a severe scenario like a 20% or greater decline in home prices combined with, say, a 200 basis point increase in the unemployment rate? How much stress can that foundation actually bear?
So much to think about, isn't there? We've covered a tremendous amount of ground today, and we sincerely hope this deep dive has given you a clearer, more nuanced, and thoroughly insightful understanding of TD Bank's unique and challenging position. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive and for continuing to think critically about these incredibly complex issues. We'll catch you next time.